We have four cases on our docket this afternoon set for oral argument. We will hear the first two, and then we'll take a brief recess, and then we will proceed with the second two. And the first case is Jerry Hamilton versus XTO Energy. And I understand that council have announced the time that they would like to take to argue, and I believe we are ready to proceed. So with that, I'll ask the clerk to call the first case.
The court will now call Jerry Hamilton versus XTO Energy. May it please the court. Melissa Lazon will argue for Jerry T. Hamilton, who is a panelist, and Howard Kratzky will argue for Mr. Cavalier.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Melissa Bazan, and I represent the appellant, Jerry Hamilton. Sitting to my left is my co-counsel, Ralph Red Gregory, Jr. And this suit is against the appellee, XTO Energy, Inc. I'm here today to ask this court to set aside the lower court's order granting XTO's second motion for summary judgment and to refer this case back to the lower court. As stated in Hernandez v. Brinker, the defendant must establish that Chapter 95 is applicable to this case for it to receive the protection of Chapter 95, and must establish that it's applicable to this case. I believe that the first requirement under Chapter 95.002 is that it must be a property owner. And I believe that in its second motion for summary judgment, XTO did not establish this requirement. In our request for production number 24, we requested that any and all documents that identify the owner of the site subject to this lawsuit be produced. Defendant produced several documents. There were several documents from the Texas Railroad Commission, and also in its motion for summary judgment evidence, it produced an affidavit from one Jeff Lemus, which testified that in August 2008, a Marshall Young Oil Company assigned its oil, gas, and mineral interest to XTO. However, this incident, which forms the basis of this lawsuit, occurred in 2006. So it was November 7, 2006. So at this time, XTO was not the property owner of this well site.
Were they the operator?
Well, I guess they produced some documents that said, I believe there were some of the documents from 2001, 2004 that established that it had some dealings with the well site. And I believe in the affidavit it says, mentioned 2008. However, they didn't produce any documents to establish that at the time of the accident that they were the lessees.
I'm not sure the lessee is the operator, but in any event, will you agree that the operator, purposes of Chapter 95, is an owner?
Well, it says in some of the documents that they, or their case law, it says, that a lessee, if they have mineral gas lease, that they do constitute, as the owner, but they haven't established that they owned it at the time. Like I said, in this affidavit, it states that they were granted a mineral and gas lease in 2008. So I believe that they weren't the property owner at the time of the accident. Okay, so moving forward. So in addition to proving that they weren't the property owner, XTO must also approve that Mr. Hamilton's injury arose from the condition or use of an improvement to real property where the contractor or subcontractor renovates, modifies, constructs, or repairs the improvement to the land. And I believe that Mr. Hamilton's injury did not arise from the improvement to the real property. It arose from fatigue that he suffered, and actually fatigue that he incurred, and also the other gentlemen that work at the site from the long hours and their excessive grueling schedules that they worked with. I believe the expert reports say that it was a contributing cause. We provided Dr. Mittler with documents that we had that we received from XTO, and from his curse from reviewing all the information that we provided him, he believed that fatigue was a contributing factor to what happened at the accident. I believe so. I believe that because he reviewed all the documents, and if you take a look at the affidavit that we supplied from our client, Mr. Jerry Hamilton, he explained the excessive work schedule that they had to deal with. He would wake up at his home. I guess on average, a lot of these gentlemen didn't live in Decatur. They would drive about an hour or so to work, and then once they all arrived at the job site, they would travel about 1.5 to 2 hours to the work site and work 12-hour shifts, sometimes as long as 16 or 17 hours, and they would have to drive back home. And so I guess just a common sense approach, and one gets fatigued if you have this schedule almost every day. And so we think that his fatigue and then the fatigue of the other gentlemen that were there with the miscommunication and the human error resulted in the accident. I think if you just go by common sense reports, I guess the way that we were seeing that was that these gentlemen, I guess there was miscommunication because they work such long hours and just a grueling schedule that it leads to this human error.
How does that fit into Chapter 95?
But we're saying, I guess, that because here you have to prove that the injury arose from a condition or use of the improvement to real property, and we're saying that the fatigue and the human error that was caused didn't have to do
who constructs, repairs, renovates, or modifies an improvement to real property?
Yes.
And I think the case law says that if you're out there drilling, that constitutes improvement to real property. Mm-hmm. So I'm not clear how fatigue fits in there.
Well, we're saying that the fatigue, because if let's just say Mr. Hamilton had fallen in the well or if he had tripped or something, that would have to do, I think, with the improvement of real property. But however, we're saying that this issue arose from fatigue, and it wasn't a condition or use of the improvement to real property. It was that's why their claim doesn't fall under Chapter 95.
Okay, I don't see reading that what you're saying.
Okay. And so, let me see. We do believe we have. I think the issue that Mr. Klatsky had brought up in his motion for summary judgment is that we didn't have any duty, or that XTO didn't offer any duty to Hamilton. I believe that's incorrect. I believe that he had several duties, especially to have a safe workplace, a reasonably safe workplace. If you look at XTO's safety, health, and environmental policy, it has a little laundry list of ways that it says it'll keep everyone safe. Or just to read one, it says it's committed to protecting the health and safety of its employees, contractors, and it just kind of lists, I think it creates a duty just stating all the ways it's going to protect everyone and keep them safe, and I think it breached that duty. Yes, it does. If Chapter 5 were to apply, I guess these would be preempted. But we strongly feel that XTO is not a property owner. And because it's not a property owner, we would be able to go forward on our negligence issues.
Just as a procedural matter, the trial court's first summary judgment was granted on no evidence grounds, and you're not challenging that ruling.
No, we're challenging the second.
Second summary judgment only on the negligence claim.
Yes, because we had included several new causes of action, and so we're just going forward on those. And those are the ones that are listed. Okay. So as I was saying, we don't believe the XTO is a property owner, but I guess if the court had determined that it was, we must prove that XTO had contractual exercise control over the well site, and also that it was aware of the danger or condition at the well site that resulted in Mr. Hamilton's injury. And we do believe that the XTO had contractual control and exercise control over the well site, It has a, it employed Mr. Frank Cummings. He was the foreman, and so he was an independent contractor. And so we believe that them employing Mr. Cummings, it was it showed a contractual control. And so we think that they hired Mr. Cummings as kind of a liability shield to make it seem like he was in control, or when he wasn't around, maybe that Bobcat or Mercer were in control. But they were, I think in actuality, XGO had was fully had their hands in what was going on. If you take a look at Mr. Cummings's his contract, I can't remember the exact name of the document, his contract, it shows what he can do and what he can't do. And if you take a look at that, it says that he can't do a lot of things without XGO's permission, such as performing services to third parties without his their consent. XGO exercised control by controlling the vendors that Mr. Cummings could select. And so I think they had their hand in what Mr. Cummings did. So I think that kind of showed that they had control over the site. And also, they were just trying to give the appearance that Frank Cummings was in control of everything, but I believe XGO was in control, and that establishes a control issue. And on the other prong of that is that XGO had actual knowledge of the danger or condition that caused Hamilton's injury and failed to adequately warn of it. I believe
so,
that.
So what warning do you think should have been given?
I think that they could have been just maybe given some safety training or something about regarding fatigue, and because they are obviously, I think XGO was aware of the grueling schedules on their job tickets. It has little timesheets that shows how long they were working there. And so I believe that that constitutes knowledge that they knew that these gentlemen are out there for long hours at a time. And so knowing that, they could have maybe instituted just training, maybe just let them know, I guess, once they're fatigued, like what to do. Maybe they could just take a break or something, institute some sort of training or procedures so they would know what to do in case something like that happened, to kind of recognize these symptoms. I guess it seems like it would be common knowledge. But I guess when they're out there working 6 or 7 days a week, 18 or so hours, they probably are just trying to push forward and just trying to gain money for their families without wanting to stop. But once they recognize these issues and everything, they probably would be more willing to just take a break whenever they notice that they're being fatigued. I believe that in addition to having this knowledge of the job tickets and seeing the extent of the workers' hours that they were working, I believe they probably could physically see the fatigue of the workers. And I'm sure on the day that the accident occurred, they said there was a miscommunication, and there was, I believe Mr. Hamilton may have given a signal. Someone else didn't notice it, and I think it was kind of later in the day, like 6 or 7. And so I'm sure by that time, they're probably just very fatigued and very tired, that they probably just there was a miscommunication and things didn't go the way they were supposed to.
And who is they?
I think since XGO in their service agreement, they said that they would do everything to provide safety and everything, I think the XGO should have had someone there. And actually at the time of the accident, XGO, the foreman, Mr. Cummings, he actually left the site to go vote. And so he wasn't even present at the time. So we think, if you take a look at the, I don't have it here with me, but if you take a look at their service agreement along in there, it says that XGO has a little laundry list of what they would take care of. So I'm sure Bobcat's going to take care of itself and obviously promise to promote safety and everything, but also XGO promised the same thing and offered that it would provide safety and training. I think also it also provided that it would promote that it would have classes and training available for safety, which they didn't do. Because when we questioned their XGO safety coordinator, James Yeager, he said that they didn't have classes, and Mr. Frank Cummings said that he didn't have any training on fatigue or some of the safety issues. He didn't have any training.
So that would be a breach of contract claim?
Excuse me, what was that?
That would be a breach of contract claim?
That sounds like that. I'm sure we could have also done that as well, but that's also a breach of contract. Yes. Let's see. And also something else that XTO stated in its master service agreement with Bobcat was that XTO will accomplish its goal of being committed to protecting the health and safety of its employees and contractors by applying reasonable standards where law or regulations do not exist. So I think in applying reasonable standards, they could have kept an eye on the workers. They could have kept an eye on the workers' schedules, make sure no one was suffering too much fatigue, and maybe try to limit the commute or something around those areas. But I believe that XTO is not a property owner in this case. I believe they did not provide any evidence to show that they were over the property at the time of the accident. I believe, because in their brief, they said that it was uncontroverted that they were owners, and I believe that's not true. You can't simply just rely on an assumption that you're an owner. You have to prove that. And I believe my time is almost up. I'd just like to say anything else I wasn't able to address, just please refer to the brief in that instance. Yes. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm Howard Klatsky. I'm appearing here today for the appellee, XTO Energy. We're asking that the rulings made by the trial court be affirmed. And before we dive into the details, I think I can summarize our position very briefly for the court. First of all, we believe that we have established that Chapter 95 does apply in this case, and I'll explain why in just a few moments. Second of all, because of that, the claims of Mr. Hamilton fail unless he can present evidence of control, either contractual control or the exercise of actual control over the means, methods, or details of the snubbing operation that was being conducted, or knowledge of an alleged dangerous condition. And I know Justice McCoy was asking about the fatigue. My understanding of Mr. Hamilton's claim is that this alleged fatigue somehow created an alleged dangerous condition. No, I don't think it has any applicability for several reasons, and I may be getting ahead of myself, but I concur with a question that Justice Gabriel asked, which is, do you have to have proximate cause or do you simply have to have contributing cause? We think there has to be evidence of proximate cause. We think evidence of contributing cause is insufficient as a matter of law. But also, in response to something that Justice McCoy mentioned, we think that the unless they can present evidence of control, this fatigue issue doesn't even come into play. And we also believe that the common law claims are all preempted. Now, there are a few key facts here. First of all, it's undisputed that Mr. Hamilton was employed by an independent contractor named Bobcat, also known as Black Warrior Electric. He was performing a snubbing operation for purposes of well control, and was injured when, according to his own brief, the negligence of another independent contractor, Mercer Well Service, caused his hand to become trapped between a piece of metal and either a sand line or a winch line. Now, the MSA, we did have an MSA or a master service agreement or contract in place with Bobcat, and I respectfully disagree with what counsel told the panel a few minutes ago. I think the agreement is very clear. The obligations that it places upon Bobcat are substantial, and I'm not going to bore the panel by reading them all, but they were to provide all personnel, they were to provide all necessary safeguards to protect all aspects of the work and all persons to do the work, they were to take all necessary safety precautions, they were to do their work in a safe and workmanlike manner, they were to provide necessary safety equipment for themselves and their employees, and by contrast, XTO's obligations under this MSA were extremely limited. There were three items. Number one, furnish materials and equipment that XTO agreed to furnish. Number two, furnish access to the site. And number three, furnish necessary construction utilities. And that's it. And none of Mr. Hamilton's claims concern any of those things. Now, the summary judgment record includes a lot of testimony. And there are a few items of testimony that Mr. Hamilton gave that I think are of extreme importance here. First of all, as Justice Gabriel sort of alluded to, I think, even Mr. Hamilton admitted that he believed the root cause of this accident was lack of communication between Bobcat crew and Mercer crew, not XTO. And he also testified that upon his arrival at the location, he was in charge of the location, and that when the company man, Frank Cummings, was not present at the job site, it was literally his operation and he ran the show. The other thing he said was that the injury that he suffered, where his hand got caught between the winch line or the sand line, was a hazard that he was aware of before the accident occurred. He testified that he had seen it happen before and understood that there was a potential that it could happen again when a snubbing operation was being conducted. Now, some of this testimony, all of this testimony is consistent with testimony that Mercer's rig operator gave. His name is Craig Childers, and he testified to two important things. Number one, he said that Mr. Hamilton was in charge of everything at the time of this accident. And number two, he testified that the accident occurred because Mr. Hamilton did not communicate effectively with him. And we're talking about a Mercer representative communicating with a Bobcat representative. Now, on the issue of property ownership, I agree with what Justice McCoy asked. If you are an operator under the laws of the state of Texas, you are deemed by the courts of Texas to be a property owner. And I would refer the court to the Francis versus Coastal Oil and Gas case for that proposition. It appears in our brief. There's no dispute that we were the operator of the well. There's no dispute that Mercer.
There's no dispute. It's not their burden of proof.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Thank you, sir. I should have said there should be no dispute, and I apologize. The point is, the deposition testimony that was included in the summary judgment record, some of the agreements that are in the summary judgment record, testimony given by Frank Cummings that was in the summary judgment record, the contracts that brought parties like Mercer and Bobcat out to the site, all demonstrate that, at a minimum, we were an operator. First of all, I agree with you, Justice, but the evidence is Mr. Frank Cummings testifying about his role out there and who he was working for and who he was reporting to and what was being conducted out there. His testimony that XTO had all the legals on the lease during the time period that this work was being done. That's the evidence that we're specifically referring to. But let me make another point that I haven't heard, at least I didn't hear counsel raise. And I'm going to be quoting to the Painter versus Momentum Energy case, which is cited in our brief, which stands for the proposition that Chapter 95 applies to property owners and to their agents who oversee the properties. And there's no dispute about the fact that XTO was out there and hiring these independent contractors to come out there and do the type of work that we're here today to talk about. There is no dispute about that fact. Now, if Chapter 95, and by the way, in the unlikely event that this panel disagrees and decides that Chapter 95 does not apply, we still think the court's ruling was appropriate under a no evidence standard, and hopefully I'm going to be able to get there. Just in case, let me get there very quickly now. We don't think that the appellant, Mr. Hamilton, presented any competent evidence demonstrating that we breached any alleged duty owed, assuming we did owe a common law duty. And we don't believe that Mr. Hamilton presented any evidence which would lead a reasonable juror to conclude that anything that XTO did or did not do was a proximate cause of this accident. The only evidence that they attempt to rely on to prove that this alleged fatigue caused a lack of communication is the report from Dr. Mittler. And as Justice Gabriel referenced in her questioning, you can read that report all day and all night. The words proximate cause simply do not appear in there. Mr. Hamilton never testified that he was fatigued. There's no evidence in the record which indicates that any of these workers, either Bobcat or Mercer, complained to XTO or to Mr. Cummings about any alleged fatigue. And hopefully I'll have time to get to some of this case law that I've brought to discuss today. That is simply insufficient. proximate cause is indisputably a necessary element. Contributing cause is flat out insufficient as a matter of law. The other point that I would make about that is that when we talk about a dangerous condition, if Chapter 95 does apply, it has to be a concealed defect. And the courts have defined that very clearly to say that it is something dangerous separate and apart from action by another. The winch line and the sand line were perfectly fine and safe by all accounts until the Bobcat crew and the Mercer crew did what it did and had ineffective communication. Very quickly, on this issue of improvements, repairs, and renovations, Mr. Hamilton acknowledged that he was at the site to perform well control. This involved use of a snubbing basket and the winch line and the sand line. We think the case law is clear, beginning with Francis versus Coastal. Work done on oil and gas wells, including rehab of oil and gas wells, constitutes repairs or renovations. Additionally, Chapter 95 applies where the injury arises from work done on an improvement, even if the object causing the injury is not itself an improvement. So in other words, if the snubbing materials aren't an improvement, it doesn't matter because the well that was being worked on is an improvement. Now, if this court agrees that Chapter 95 applies, Mr. Hamilton's got to prove control and knowledge of the danger. Even before Chapter 95 came into existence, the law was pretty clear. Generally, property owners were not subject to liability for injuries sustained by independent contractors because the owner has no duty to see that the independent contractors perform their work in a safe manner. Case law also says that, generally speaking, owners are not insurers. The legislature, according to the case law, adopted Chapter 95 because it recognized that property owners often want to hire independent contractors who have expertise to repair or renovate improvements on their property. And I would refer the court to the Exxon versus Quinn case cited in the brief, Supreme Court of Texas. It is well established that the responsibility for conducting a task in a safe manner rests with the independent contractor where it's conducted by the independent contractor and under control of the independent contractor, and where the danger arises out of the independent contractor's performance of the task. The bottom line is this. XTO did not control the snubbing operation under the terms of the master service agreement. It did not have the right to do so. It had no knowledge of any alleged fatigue that, according to Mr. Hamilton, led to this miscommunication. Now, on the issue of control, I just want to make a couple of brief global points. I think we all understand it must be more than the right to order work to stop and start, to inspect the premises, and to make recommendations. Instead, it must relate directly to the activity that caused the injury. It's a very narrow standard, and as this court said in McClure versus Denham, the duty of care will arise only when control over the means, methods, or details of the independent contractor's work is either retained or actually exercised. In that same case, this court recognized that every owner must have some latitude to tell its independent contractor what to do in general terms without being subject to liability. Now, on the issue of contractual control, I've talked about the MSA. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I just want to share one thing with you that, embarrassingly, I didn't point out in my brief, but it's in the record. Section Roman numeral 12 of the MSA, titled Independent Contractor, says, subject to the provisions of section 11.5.2, if applicable, and that section applies to work done in the state of Louisiana only. So setting that aside, it says, contractor and any subcontractor, meaning Bobcat, will have complete and sole control over their respective employees and the details of the work performed and the methods by which the work is accomplished, it being understood that XTO is interested only in the results the contractor obtains. So in addition to everything else that we've shared with the court in the briefing and all of the obligations that were placed upon Bobcat, we also have that language here, and this document is signed by a representative of Bobcat. There is nothing in these documents that gives XTO the contractual right to direct or control the means, methods, or details of the snubbing operation. And, yes, sir.
It seems to me that her strongest point is 95.0022, where it says that this chapter only applies to claims that arise, which we'll assume means caused by, the condition or use of the improvement. Well, from what I've heard and read, what caused the accident was miscommunication, and she would say caused by fatigue, that miscommunication and fatigue are not condition or use of an improvement.
No, sir, I think that's a fair statement. However, what I would add to that is the case law that we've cited, I think, is pretty clear that we look at what was being done at the time of the accident. And what was being done was a snubbing operation between two subcontractors, and the snubbing operation was being done in order to make this well safe. In other words, they were there to provide well control. And so when we look at that, again, Chapter 95, according to the case law, and I'm referring primarily to the Francis case, applies where injury arises from work done on an improvement. We know they were doing work on the well. They were conducting a snubbing operation at the time of the accident. But Justice McCoy, if the point that you're making is, well, if they're just saying fatigue caused a miscommunication and it has nothing to do with anything that was out there at the site, I guess we go back to the no evidence portion of our motion, and I restate what I said earlier. Where is the evidence that we breached a duty? Where is the evidence of proximate cause? And respectfully, I think there's just absolutely none. And I guess let me get into that now. I wanted to briefly talk about actual control. And I see I'm almost out of time. There's no evidence that we told these people what to do out there. Our company man was not even present. And on the issue of fatigue, I would just refer the court to the case law that we've cited. Knowledge about somebody's commute time and work schedule without more does not raise a fact issue. And that's Goodyear Tire versus Mays, Supreme Court of Texas, 2007. Thank you.
I just want to touch on a couple of the points that Mr. Klatsky brought up. I don't think I'll be taking the whole 5 minutes. Mr. Klatsky had brought up that to establish that XTO was the owner, that their evidence was Mr. Cummings and other company workers said that they knew that XTO was the owner, that they were aware of the paperwork or something like that. I just wanted to say that Mr. Cummings knowing that XTO was the owner is not sufficient. He was just the company foreman. He would have no knowledge of any contracts, any upper-level information that would have to deal with any leases or anything like that. So Mr. Cummings just having offhand knowledge that maybe XTO owned the property, I don't think would be sufficient enough to prove that XTO was the owner. He would have no way of knowing, I guess, who owned the lease aside from someone just kind of telling him.
I think what he said was that Mr. Cummings testified that XTO was responsible for all the legals on the lease, meaning they were the operator.
Okay.
I could have misunderstood.
Okay, I guess the way
is that evidence in the record?
I do recall him saying, I think, that he just knew that XTO handled the paperwork or something like that. I don't remember the exact wording, Your Honor.
Well, what is the operator?
Excuse me, what was that?
What is the operator of the well?
The operator of the well, I believe that XTO was responsible for just kind of what was going on at the well and some of the operations, but they never proved that they were the property owner. So I think that's...
The operator is deemed to be the property owner, correct? For purposes of Chapter 95?
Yes, but I don't think that they have provided any evidence. I know they have provided some case law, but until they prove that I have any documents to show that they were the owner at the time of the accident, I don't believe that they were the property owner at the time of the accident. We first sued XTO, Mercer, and then Bobcat, and we believe, I guess, since they were there at the well site, we sued them because they were overseeing everything. They hired the independent contractors, Mercer and Bobcat, and they were just kind of overseeing everything, so we felt that they were also responsible for what happened. We're just assumed that they're the operator. It's up to XTO to establish that they were, and under for their claims to fall under Chapter 95. They need to prove themselves. And also just to go off what Judge McCoy said, that fatigue and miscommunication are what caused the accident, and they did not arise from the condition or the improvement of the land. Just want to touch on that. And that's all.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn. Thank you, Mr. Putsky. We appreciate your arguments here today. Your case is submitted. You are free to go about your business, and we will proceed with the second case after y'all had a chance to gather your things and go about your business.
Thank you. Thank you very much.